Time for another chat with State Representative Tacky Chan of Quincy, who is back at home. Tacky, how are you?
Good to see you, Joe. Yeah, I'm back at home today. I'm not on the road. I'm trying to get from place to place. So this is, again, the norm for all the audiences.
But it won't be for long because come May 29th, looks like pandemic is officially over here in Massachusetts, according to the governor, at least.
According to the governor, you're correct. A mask mandate ends on the 29th of May. Full occupancy comes back into effect for basically everything. So basically phase four normal is what essentially it is. And the state of emergency will end on June 15th. Of course, this is all tentative because the governor could change his mind, but right now the indication is no. The science seems to support the governor's position in Massachusetts around vaccinations. So the CDC and other medical groups, researchers so far indicate that if you're fully vaccinated, you're not a carrier. The viral load in your body does not get a chance to generate high enough to become a carrier. So if you get the COVID virus and you're vaccinated, it doesn't mean that there is no virus in your body, right? The virus is in your body, but your vaccine teaches your body to create create antibodies to fight off the virus. If there's not a virus replication to reach a certain size, and then you exhale, there's no virus coming out of your system. There's not enough of it. So the objective, of course, is for your body to generate enough antibodies to be it down to the point where it can't replicate enough to be for you to become a transmitter. Again, I tell people, wash your hands, because just because it's not coming out of your lungs doesn't mean it doesn't stick to your hands on surfaces. But this is the whole concept of getting herd immunity. And as of this week, I don't remember the exact number, but 3.2 million people are now fully vaccinated, which is about 47% of the population of 7.1 million. There's almost 4 million people with dose one. I think a little over 4 million people with dose one already. So what does that mean? The governor's objective number is 4.1 million vaccinated to try to achieve a herd immunity. That is the magic number out of a population of 7 million. We do know that young children are not being vaccinated yet, as we know teenagers are. So obviously a number from 4.1 is going to grow a bit because that's just the adult population.
Right.
So we've thrown to teenagers, and obviously that's going to nudge you closer to over 5 million folks to be vaccinated. And this, the closer we get to all teenagers vaccinated, our herd immunity improves dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
And then, now we're just waiting for the studies to get done on young children.
Of course, it doesn't account for visitors to the state. However, the entire New England region, actually, from the map that I looked at, is highly vaccinated.
That's correct. I mean, the theory is that if you have one person who's unvaccinated and you have everyone around you vaccinated, the virus cannot be transmitted because it cannot be on any vaccinated person.
Right.
But if you have more than one person unvaccinated, let's say there's 5 out of 100 person in a room, so 95 people vaccinated, you got 5 non-vaccinated, and one of those people is a COVID carrier. The reality, since you have people around them vaccinated, it still has to somehow reach the other 4 unvaccinated folks. So is it possible? Of course it's possible. We have a room small enough, 100 people, and 5 people are not vaccinated, and one of the 5 is a carrier.
Mm-hmm.
You could still reach one of the 4 other people. But if you're isolated, that person of a bunch of other folks that aren't carriers and never physically get to at the other 4 unvaccinated folks, then herd immunity prevents any movement. That's basically the principle. So,
yeah, there are all kinds of viruses going all the time. It's just the whole goal is to tamp down the pandemic level of the virus.
That's absolutely correct. Reduce the possibility of it. So this is, people probably saw the news, I believe was a 7 or 9 New York Yankees got COVID positive, even though they were vaccinated, but only one came out of any kind of very, very, very mild symptoms. So
right.
The idea is that this will be reduced to the discomfort level of a basic cold. And that's the hope. And there's always a possibility for hospitalization, but it's reduced to the same possibility as the common cold, needing a hospitalization, same probability. So that's kind of the objective here.
Yeah, and I just read this morning, actually, that the likelihood for a booster shot later this year is decreasing as more studies are done.
Yeah, we'll just keep waiting for the studies. I mean, this is as we go, learn as we go. I mean, we live in the most technologically advanced period in the history of mankind. And, you know, in the United States continues to be a world leader regarding education, biotechnology, new tech, and intellectual property. I mean, you know, people have this thought of America decline. Well, the answer is no. I mean, we're you know, first to have the best studies, not only this stuff, and we're using the most advanced technology possible. And this is our spot in the world. I do understand that, you know, our neighbors to the north are still struggling to get more vaccine. Our neighbors to the south was planning to make their own, which I'm not sure how the Mexican government's going to pull that one off, but that's what they're thinking now. And in the interim, I mean, other countries who are using not our technology, other technology to generate monstrous amount of vaccine does not have the same efficacy rate. So our you know, Johnson & Johnson's 82% and above, and you know, you got Moderna Pfizer well into 90% and above, 95% above. You know, some of the other vaccines are closer to 50% efficacy.
Right.
But at the same time, though, if even 50% efficacy is fine, because you should have a vaccination, then not, because you still 100% no death.
Right.
That's the objective.
That's right. Yep. You don't overwhelm your healthcare system. You know, you don't have a pandemic. You have, you know, some sick people that are going to get better.
That's exactly it. I mean, efficacy rate is only about whether or not you could get COVID. People don't talk about the fact that the goal is to A, not die, not to have severe illnesses. So even if you have a Chinese Sinovac at 50% efficacy or 60% efficacy, the big thing is this: you're not going to die, and you're not going to be severely ill. That's the point of all this, right? And you know, I repeat again, you know, people complain to me and talk, oh, I shouldn't do this, I don't have to do that because it's only 2% death rate. The point isn't the death rate. The point is the fact you don't overrun the healthcare system with 10 or 15% people needing medical care of the infected population. And, you know, people know at this stage, you know, we have millions and millions of people, tens of millions of people that have been infected by COVID. Even a fraction of that population, you know, needed severe hospitalization. We don't have the capacity. And nor does any country on the planet,
right,
regardless of the socioeconomics, have the capacity for large severe illnesses overwhelming the ICUs. So that's kind of a big part of all this conversation about vaccinations. It's the fact that it's not about, per se, just the efficacy. It's about whether you're going to be severely ill or die if you don't get the vaccine.
Period. End of story. Yeah, exactly. Can we talk a little bit? I'm curious about what the expiration of the state of emergency will actually mean for things like remote communication, like we're doing now when it comes to public meetings.
Ah, well, welcome to the mystery question.
Yeah.
The legislation did not know this was coming. And I referred to it as the being on the bus, someone stepping on the brake, and the rest of us jerk.
Okay. I think it took a lot of people by surprise, yes.
It most likely took me by surprise. I mean, there's several reasons for it. I mean,
there was, you know, we went from August 1st to May 29th in the matter of 3 days. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty, pretty remarkable. So the governor's state of emergency ends. That means his war powers end as well. And this was been running under the 1952 war powers. It was like a continuation of war powers from World War II into Korea, and you know, in the Cold War era, I call it Cold War era powers. What it also means is what happens to executive orders, which only have effect because of Cold War era powers. And welcome to the question we don't have an answer for.
Okay. All right.
Talked about in the past about mail-in ballots, or how absentee ballots is actually a very strict state constitutional provision, and whether we have to amend the Constitution to allow continuation of mail-in ballots. So legal minds are right now trying to figure out, you know, what are we allowed to do post state of emergency on things like mail-in ballots. So we don't have an answer yet.
Okay,
we've talked about this before, just the two of us, regarding, you know, very strict wording. Using the word impede as a way to use mail-in ballots as part of COVID.
Yep.
But there's no new definitive legal review. So I'm sure Secretary Garrett's office, the governor's office, election laws committees are right now trying to sort out that, among other things, right? In my world, I have two things going. Take out alcohol and outdoor dining this time to the executive order. So this is going to be a little confusing, folks, so try to follow me on this. The governor's powers, war powers, is what let him does his executive orders. So, for example, you know, dialing outdoor dining is directly tied to the war powers. He created a whole executive order regulatory structure outside of the general laws to allow expedited process for outdoor dining.
Mm-hmm.
His executive order says that 60 days after the end of state emergency, outdoor dining ends.
Mm. Okay.
Question. How can that 60 days still exist in terms of a power if the state of emergency is over? So he's going to try to keep something in effect where he no longer has authority over.
Okay, so does that mean the legislature then has to step in and take action?
That's exactly the question.
Okay.
So we're trying to sort this out now, because on the one thought process is that if the executive order does have power after the state of emergency ends and after war powers aren't allowed, and that executive order still can continue, then we have some time to figure it out. If the answer is no, and that 60 days is invalid, because it only, that 60 day period must be during a wartime power, then the general laws apply again.
Okay. All right, so we'll need an answer to that question soon.
Yeah, we're trying to work this out on a committee level, and we've talked to the governor's office about this on my level. So I got some language ready to go, but to try to see if we can sort this out,
yeah,
at least to the end of the calendar year. And my committee's already got some language to address this as a permanent fixture, a regulatory mm-hmm. process to a more transparent and open process than the governor's executive order to give people better notice and understand what's going on, and an expedited review process for licensing boards to allow outdoor dining going into the future.
Yeah.
But for now, outdoor dining's in place. Outdoor dining has been done under a expedited, I would argue, less than transparent process by the governor established. I have no interest in disrupting the current situation of approved outdoor dining, and pretty much anybody who wanted outdoor dining got their approval long before winter ended.
So people
got that process moving right away. So I don't want to screw that up. The other thing,
that's though, beneficial to the establishments for sure. Yeah,
that's correct. And the other thing that also ends by statute is the takeout alcohol.
So
people had enjoyed taking alcohol during the height of pandemic. We're trying to keep some of the restaurants out on takeout. But you know, the word I'm hearing back by colleagues in the legislature and other folks is that once any type of indoor or outdoor dining started, takeout alcohol interest declined dramatically.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
It's not cost effective for restaurants, to be perfectly frank with you, unless you just basically, you know, just all you do is sell alcohol.
Yeah, so, and package stores never closed. So there was always that option. Yeah.
And you're paying premium price for takeout alcohol.
Sure.
Rather than, I mean, a glass of wine is much more expensive than it is getting a bottle from
packaging. Oh, for sure, yeah.
So there's that economic component that people, you know, are aware of.
Mm-hmm.
But if you go to the restaurant, you can, you know, obviously you order a drink and you may get a second appetizer. You know, you may get that second drink, which basically means you probably paid for like a bottle of wine already.
Right, right? Yes.
You may decide to stick around for dessert. And of course, most importantly, it addresses the tip income. Because, you know, people are very dependent on tips.
Yes.
And if you can, and you feel it's deserved, you know, I do encourage people to try to tip well, based on what you can afford, obviously.
For sure.
And you feel how service was done, because people in hospitality, especially restaurants, the servers, make their salary on your tips, which mm-hmm. argue about that a different day, about my thoughts in that matter. But,
right.
You know, everyone needs a little help here. So, you know, obviously never tell people to spend more than you can afford.
But, of course,
you know,
yeah.
Do what you can. So, you know, the feeling I'm getting from my colleagues and other folks I'm talking to is that we'll just let takeout alcohol expire at the end of the state of emergency.
Yeah, no, I think it's like you say, is if you're able to sit and dine at the restaurant, either indoors or out, it's much more pleasurable to have your alcohol there than, you know, have to rush to the restaurant, grab it and take it home. It's a social aspect of it.
And as we come to more opening and people starts to acclimate themselves to post-pandemic life, or I think there'll still be a little bit of pandemic life left at certain levels, but people are going to have home parties again. You're not going to do takeout alcohol from restaurants as part of takeout.
Right. Yeah.
You're going to go to the packet and get what you need to bring to your house party, and then you order your takeout separately.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. The one thing that is sticking around, I guess, though, is telehealth. Is that right, Jackie? That's not going away. At least, I don't know about the insurance part of it, but at least the availability part of it.
We passed a telehealth bill at the end of the session in
Yeah.
December. It was like so long and not so long ago when we closed the session last year. Telehealth was actually part of the healthcare reform bill.
Okay.
There is insurance. I believe there is an insurance reimbursement component of it. I'm trying to remember off the top of my head now, but we definitely did codify a lot of the regulations that were put as emergency into telehealth today.
Okay.
So telehealth is here to stay. The technology will continue to advance in telehealth. We have higher resolution. I mean, even using my telephone here for Zoom, on a video call, you can take high quality photos like I did for my mom actually, and send it through the secure app. And healthcare provider, and then they can look at the high quality photos that way, and then try to help with diagnosis. So you're going to see, camera technology is obviously very much improved on cell phones, but on other devices, I think you'll see a large improvement on other devices, portable devices, cameras as part of telemedicine. So that's here to stay. I do believe a portion of white collar workers are going to still be at home, a hybrid model. What the governor's already announced a hybrid model. And we'll see how the teachers and the union with the school administrators deal with snow days, whether or not they actually have snow days. That's a conversational piece. And even in higher education, this creates also other opportunities for them to try to generate revenue on tele education. Right now, obviously, the school season is ending again, sadly, for another group of graduates, both high school and college graduates, still had a very challenging year trying to get to it, even though you could have, more of a normal graduation. But it doesn't exactly erase the whole past year of just trying to deal with the situation.
Sure.
But
I know Quincy College is offering both in-person and online classes over the summertime. I think you'll see a lot of that too.
I agree. And I think summer programs would be really good for that, particularly for people who want to go home and be with their family, but also want to catch up some classes. It'll be interesting coming up soon is regarding international students and how they're going to get back to Massachusetts. We get an influx, a huge influx of international students, which is a big part of the economy here. And the healthcare isn't equal everywhere.
Boy, that's true, as we're seeing in India right now.
Absolutely. So, I know everyone's like, got this like stance of vaccine passports or whatnot, but I mean, this isn't just the ability to have business people come over that aren't tourists. And we also have like medical, what we call medical tourism out of rich countries that come to MGH. And, obviously, we got to still conduct our international business, not just, in Europe or Asia, but you also have in the Americas. I mean, you still have to do business with Canada, which is our a major trading partner is Canada. People don't always realize this, but it's our biggest partner is Canada. And then, they're having severe COVID meltdown. They really, need help with vaccinations because, again, they can't make any. It's all here. And we have like a fourth potential vaccine becoming available in the U.S. perhaps this fall.
Oh, really?
Novavax is getting ready for an application.
Okay.
So you got a lot of these. We're blessed here. I think we're more blessed than people realize by the sheer industrial might in the United States compared to other countries.
I think
And
it's pretty evident, given that we're giving out vaccines like water now, and even first world countries like Japan are struggling.
absolutely, they're struggling, and we're going to have to help our allies out going forward. But again, this is a whole put on your mask in the airplane situation. If we can't keep this thing under control here, it's going to be enormously difficult for the U.S. to help other countries. And the U.S. policy regarding our friends is we're going to help our friends. I mean, it's an old policy; it's not a new one. But if we're under a COVID meltdown, severe COVID meltdown, there's no way we can, help anybody else. So this is kind of the situation we're in. So the question really becomes, folks, is not, COVID passports necessary for us, but should we have COVID identification, medical verification, or vaccination before they come here? And that's because, you have a plane full of folks, and they're not vaccinated, and someone has COVID on that plane. That's what happened to a friend of mine that came back from UK on whatever wave they were in when they left. They found a guy infected COVID en route from England to here. So think about that for those watching. Should people complain about us? So well, we shouldn't have to verify. Well, okay, what about other people then? Do you want other people potentially infected?
Yeah, it's a slippery slope for sure. We saw it in the cruise industry too, back at the beginning of the pandemic. So there are no borders for viruses.
No, and the airlines and the cruise industry wants to operate normally as possible as well. I mean, cramming us into small spaces the most they can. I mean, they like to go back to that. But they're also very cognizant of the fact that this puts their crew at risk.
Right.
And again,
puts their business at risk, right? So, yeah.
Put their business at risk. And some of these industries are global industries. They don't just have U.S. employees. They have global employees.
Mm-hmm.
The travel industry has global employees.
Oh, and so, yeah, no, the Philippines is a big employer for the travel industry.
Absolutely. And mm-hmm. it's in the best interest of the travel industry for those people to get vaccinated.
Mm-hmm.
And the Philippines, for example, is not a wealthy country who is going to have to be, talk about vaccine economy two calls ago, but, they're going to have a harder time to compete against bigger countries with much more money.
Right.
And if we're dependent on them as part of the West Coast, it's mostly West Coast cruise industries, then, is it in our best interest for the United States to help these countries out, which have direct economic benefit to us, and also as a humanitarian issue, and frankly, just being good human beings?
I was just going to say, what is the downside to helping as many people as possible? What is the negative? There isn't one, right?
No, there isn't. I mean, if you want to not talk about being good human beings and want to have quantitative measurements, I mean, it has direct economic impact to us in terms of workers. Obviously, there are a lot of immigrants in this country, so they care about their families, so that creates goodwill as well. And then you also have strategic and military and economic benefits that you may get more favorable treatment from those countries.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why, again, vaccine diplomacy is full gear as the Russians and the Chinese export more than they vaccinate. So the Chinese now, I think the latest number I saw was the Chinese government's vaccinating 14 million people a day, but it's also 1.5 billion people, folks. So they're still projecting 2022 on full vaccinations while at the same time exporting an enormous amount of vaccine.
Yep.
Because you saw the Patriots playing in the news this week, transporting Sinovac Chinese vaccine.
Yeah.
To... what was the country? It's a South American country, which I forgot already.
I have too.
But it was on Channel 5 last night. It was on Channel 5. You can find it on Channel 5. The Patriot's plan is transporting Chinese vaccine to South American countries. So, that's kind of where things are. So it's kind of if you're really kind of one of those international policy wonks, this whole diplomacy of vaccines is very interesting regarding, how you're going to put the needs of your country first. But it's not just what putting needs of your country first. If you're a global leader, you got to be in a position to lead. And if your country's sick, you can't lead on an international stage.
Right.
Right. So, we're not being selfish. We just got to be able to get ourselves in a good position to help somebody else.
No, it's the story of, like you just said, you put your oxygen mask on first in the plane before you help the person next to you.
And that's exactly, I think, that is the position the United States should take. Absolutely. And, again, it's crucial for vaccinations to occur all over the country. And again, I thank everybody who's got their vaccine. But the sooner that everyone's in a good place collectively, the better place, to be honest with you, the world will be in a better place.
Mm-hmm.
We're in a good place in the United States.
Yep. Can we talk about a little local tour that you took with the House Speaker Rahm Arellano here in Quincy, Tacky?
Yes, we had a great time with a good speaker yesterday. We visited three locations as part of hashtag ShopAAIP month. We visited South Cove Manor, Lux Dental, and visited KMA Marketplace and a couple of business owners there. The goal obviously is to visit some locations and talk about how COVID's impacted them and the businesses, talk a little bit about racism and what's going on there. But most importantly, show that it's okay to come out now slowly, and it's okay and good to support our own businesses. In my lifetime, I don't remember ever doing an AAPI shop promotion. If someone here listening has heard of one before, I'd like to hear about it. I don't remember seeing one. I mean, we spent a lot of time talking about promoting Black businesses this past year, which is great. But, you know, as I've said again, we warned people on March 20th in 2020 that this was going to be horrible for the Asian community. And it turns out we were right. I'd rather not be right, folks. When I do doom and gloom predictions, the obvious thing is I want to be as wrong as possible when I'm in doom and gloom mode, okay? So, you know, there's still an economic recovery as we're now facing not necessarily just COVID issues or the end of COVID issues, but also the continuation of fear out there regarding racist attacks, whether it be verbal or physical. And, you know, the discrimination floating around here and there. And I think it's important to highlight the diversity of it. So, speaker, you know, went around three locations and districts. So, South Cove Manor actually had a remarkable case of only 5 infections among patients, you know, almost 0 among staff. I believe it was less than 5 as well among staff. One of the few locations in the state where Sicily facility was actually very managed to COVID-19.
Yeah.
Very well managed. And they're approaching an almost 100% vaccination rate among its staff and folks. And they utilize Nick Chow's shop, Tai Tung Vintage Pharmacy, which is the only real Chinese-speaking pharmacy in Chinatown to provide him the vaccine.
And
he had complications because he's not a federal pharmacy. He's a state pharmacy. So he wasn't part of the federal vaccination program. The Fed set aside vaccine for the CVSs because it was part of the federal pharmacy program. So he's an example of those independent pharmacies. The governor should have been pushing some more vaccine too. But now abundance is a lot easier to do so than early on. And then we stopped at Lux Dental, saw Dr. Abe over there. You know, Dr. Abe is South Asian, actually South Asian Chinese. He's actually from Hong Kong, so he speaks Chinese better than I do.
Yeah.
And he talked about the latest in technology medicine. He serves a lot of mass health patients. And he decided something about Dental Cupid, where people who need emergency care, dental, during COVID, was able to find a dentist somewhere globally. Because it became a global event, not just Massachusetts, which he started this program to ensure that you need emergency services, you get some telehealth, or, you know, if it's like, you know, severe life-threatening dental issue, which can't happen, particularly with infections. An infection in your mouth can kill you.
Mm-hmm.
It can be treated someplace, somewhere immediately. So, and we also talked about how he's, you know, up this protocol game regarding COVID. And we stopped at Cayman Marketplace and we, you know, looked at some of the challenges some of the small stores are having in there. We talked to one of the restaurant owners at Full Countryside next door, about his challenges as well as such in travel. Travel agencies continue to be wrecked as a result of COVID-19. It's going to be a very slow recovery for them. And also with Queen's Asian Resources Whistle Program, which, you know, I was at last week, as well as the food delivery service they were doing for food insecurity with Canman and Sunshine Travel. So Corey, Queen's Asian Resources was coordinated between, you know, those other two groups on food insecurity issues in the Asian community, which sometimes people forget we have too. So it was a good opportunity to inform the speaker about all these different things that people are doing during COVID and, you know, how they're going to move through recovery. And you know, he also talked about things going on at the State House that, you know, that may be helpful. So, for example, we voted in the UI bill this year that corrects the solvency fund tax. So that was a big issue where employers will see a 9% spike in their unemployment insurance tax because of this solvency fund issue, which apparently a lot of people forgot about because I don't do unemployment insurance policy, so I'm not sure what this was myself.
Okay.
So what happened was that because the way they had set the schedule up on the taxation rates, they didn't realize they had basically taxed all employers at over 9% additional this quarter.
Oh.
As opposed to the normal 1.1%-ish as part of the maintained the UI solvency fund.
Oh, first I heard of this too. Okay.
You and me both.
Yes.
So, I was aware of it because a number of business folks called me about this and tried to explain to me that, you know, they had not laid anyone off or did very little layoffs because of things like PPP.
Yeah, why do we have to pay more if we have our full staff on board? Yeah,
that's correct, because they're not putting a burden on the employment system.
Right.
So, you know, both branches and the governor's office, you know, have been working on this thing together, and both House and Senate leadership and the respective committees on workforce development, as well as governor's folks, figure out what the problem is. So employers who have been doing major layoffs will continue to obviously pay a higher rate. If you're not been laying people off and you've been paying this higher rate, you're going to see a credit coming.
Okay.
So in the next quarter, there'll be a credit provided based on the actual reflection of your unemployment.
Very good. Okay.
So that's going to be correct. And then we move some money from the bond that we approved for the governor to pay for unemployment trust fund to keep it solvent, and shifted some of it around to COVID relief and COVID solvency related to unemployment. There's a couple of different funds associated with the feds on this. So we just shifted a couple of dollars around, so to speak, okay, to ensure that nothing's lost.
Right.
So this was an issue that was very complicated. I'm trying to get very simple here for you.
Yeah, no, I'm surprised it has not garnered a lot more attention. Maybe it will now.
It definitely should have made the news, I do have to say. I'm not going to lie to you folks.
Totally agree. I mean, as a news person, when I'm hearing this, I'm like, this is front page news to me. You know, where people are asleep at the switch here.
We talked about this offline as well. I mean, the media prioritization of news is kind of a mystery game for a lot of us. We have a news cycle that's now Twitter-based. You've got to be first in line, otherwise you're last in line in news.
Let's not get going on that, For someone who's been in this business over 35 years, it drives me crazy, so yeah.
I have similar frustrations as well. And people wonder why I watch a lot of international stations now. It's because that's commentary. So, when I'm watching DW.com or watching, CNA in Singapore, I'm watching the headline news, it really just is news. And then they do have commentary sections where they bring in analysts, but it's very clear that this is a commentary section.
Fine. That's what an editorial page in a newspaper is for. It's fine, yeah.
And they explicitly say it is. There is no, pretending this is real news. This is, analysts, they bring in analysts, and this is a segment that is an analyst show. Or they do on-person shows. For example, they do on the Singapore News, CNA, they were doing a Taste of Asia restaurant, unknown restaurants in Southeast Asia. And the person goes around to different countries and finds unique restaurants in countries you never thought would exist.
Oh, fun. Okay.
Nice. Because they have the fun stuff too. So, yeah. I mean, it's almost I always liked it when Anthony Bourdain was still alive. He had this travel around the world and things you would not normally see, and it was part of a CNN show.
Yes.
And of course it was also a travel channel, but there's a reason why I like to stick with international news a lot these days to get that perspective, but also the reporting is so very different.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's become so homogenized in this country. The media ownership, as is whittled down to what, basically three or four major corporations.
That's actually correct. And listen, it's all very much commentary, whether you realize it or not.
Right.
So, other places when they report in the United States is actually pretty fascinating. You just kind of report what was there and you leave it at that. And then they'll say, well, we'll bring in an analyst and a commentator, and they'll tell you their analyst and commentator. And they bring those people in and give a comment. But it is the news station. The news station itself is not the commentator.
Oh, what a concept. Yeah, okay.
What a concept. It isn't your own news anchor is making commentary. It's someone you brought as a guest who is not affiliated with News Station.
Anyway.
Yes,
we digress.
Yeah, I don't like cable news either, so just saying.
The president, though, did sign into law this week some new legislation regarding anti-Asian hate crimes in general, actually, as I'm sure you're aware, with the Justice Department.
Yeah, despite the title, it really isn't just limited to Asian Americans and COVID-19. Right. What it does is it creates a new department within the Department of Justice whose job is to expedite and review hate crimes.
Yep.
It provides some financial resources to local law enforcement to better track these hate crimes and to try to bring a more centralized data collection on these issues. One of the big problems with hate crimes is twofold. One is whether it's being charged, and two, whether it's been, how the data is collected, if it's charged, and thirdly, if they've been prosecuted, the data collection on that and what the outcomes are. So they're not very quick. If you look at any of the federal statistics, they're always delayed perhaps as high as 2 years. Well, stuff should be collected faster. But again, it relies on the bottom of the tier to report up to the tier what the data is, so to speak, the local police departments, regardless of what state you're in, you know, would have to report. So, you know, they're trying to create a more robust reporting system. They want to provide funding to help with this robust reporting system so that, you know, we actually have some clear ideas what's going on. So then we can actually take action. One of the biggest challenges, we don't have enough information. We're kind of flying blind here on decision-making. COVID's kind of proven that, okay? I mean, you know, we've already done all basically 16 months of flying blind, making policy and health decisions and research on the go. And we would continue to do so at some level as we move out of COVID. But in terms of long-term policies, just like COVID, you know, like hate crime and everything else we do, the better data we have, the better it is for advocates to advocate for services. And it's actually better for policymakers to understand what the data is as part of the totality of looking at information.
Right. Yeah. It's going to, you know, I'm just thinking how history is going to look back on this period in time, you know, when you and I are long gone. It's going to be, I think, an incredible, you know, period of growth, of development, of scientific discovery, and maybe of cultural change too.
Maybe. I mean, it's been a very turbulent 2020 when you really think about it. You know, you got COVID, but you also have BLM. Mm-hmm. And George Floyd, and the world was horrified by George Floyd. I mean, I just can't, if you're not, I just don't get it. And you know, I kind of said it best in my tweet, you know, we can believe our own eyes. And it's, you know, and I do know we live in a jaded world where people believe what they want to believe. And you could be one of those saying, watching this, listening, goes, well, I believe what I want to believe. Tacky's wrong. Well, that's true. But I mean, you know, am I wearing a blue shirt? Or am I not wearing a blue shirt here?
Right.
Right.
Yeah. There are facts. There are facts that are indisputable. Right.
That's correct. And, you know, can you believe your own eyes? And, you know, that's, you know, if you lived through Rodney King, and in particular, that's one I remember most from my childhood. You know, can you believe your own eyes? And now the days with cell phones and whatnot, you know, there are more people recording, and not just cell phones, security cameras. I mean, mm-hmm. One of the things that the trial of George Floyd was that security camera across the street, and it leads to an interesting question: is the 911 dispatcher told the supervisor, and what did the supervisor do? Nothing.
Yeah.
Nobody radioed down there and go, "Hey, we see you. What are you doing?"
That was key evidence for the prosecution, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, and that shows a systematic problem in the police department's chain of command, that even their own folks in the department see with their own eyes, believe what they're seeing, and they didn't do anything. And I think that's the real question for the Justice Department to look into. This is part of the conversation we have next time about systemic racism and how I look at the issue. But, you know, it's got to be a question that no, I don't know why anyone's not asked this simple question.
Oh, I think you're seeing the Attorney General now, Merrick Garland, looking at it for sure.
Oh, absolutely. This should be a common sense question to everybody here, particularly when that video showed up. They saw it. The dispatcher called supervisor, called for help. Dispatcher can't tell the police chief or anyone in the police department what to do. So someone with authority should have done something before this man died. And that's a legitimate question. And, you know, there's another one, you know, it's Louisiana regarding the situation claiming, you know, it was a car death, but they have body cam of them tasing and beating this man. So I know this is not a Massachusetts issue because it's very rare it happens here. I'm not saying nothing ever happens anywhere, right? It's just not likely, but not as common. But I mean, we had the back case in Springfield, you know, two mm-hmm. folks have been distorting and hurting folks in the police department. Again, not to say, you know, it's commonplace, but it does happen, folks. I mean, don't pretend it doesn't. But it really comes next to what do we do about it collectively as a society, not just lawmakers, but as, you know, people with the cell phone cameras. I mean, put down the camera and call 911. It's called a phone, cell phone camera. So, I mean, that's another part about, you know, culturally as ourselves as people, you know, shouldn't you use the phone function first as things are unfolding? And, you know, we're all very cognizant of this video everywhere now, not just on the cell phone, but, you know, in major cities, the surveillance cameras, as well as, you know, and private ones. I mean, how many Ring doorbell videos have we seen on the news now?
It's extremely prolific now, for sure, anywhere you go. Yeah.
It's not just government surveillance. It's home surveillance, private individual surveillance. It's private business surveillance. It's like we saw yesterday on the news about the construction accident at BU when he had the support beams domino over. You know, it had someone on the obscure street, able to take pictures and become basically a photogenic reporter, amateur, or provide the coverage to the news.
Right. Yep. Exactly. Yeah. Almost nothing is going unseen or unrecorded these days, especially in urban areas.
Especially in urban areas. And when you see something that happens and you don't know what happened, it's becoming increasingly shocking because of the fact that, you know, we ourselves have become the surveillance state in some ways, right? Because of nature of camera phones and other types of cameras.
I say it all the time. Google knows way more about me than the government does.
Knows more about me too.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, thank God. I don't remember this, but somewhere on the internet it does.
That's right. Exactly.
So, I mean, it's been a rough year. And of course, you know, you top of the Asian stuff and you can see all the cell phone video, you can see all the security cam video around the country. And again, I mean, you know, I'm not aware of major incidents here, but if you look at the latest Stop AIP Hate website, you know, please do visit the website. They actually put a new report out for just 2 weeks in March. And I'm trying to remember this off the top of my head, but the number of incidents reported during that last 2 weeks of March almost doubled the reporting for the entire prior year. And then there is actually an anecdotal comment in the back, because people can write anonymously things that happened to them and they put it as part of the report. In Boston, an Asian woman, I believe Chinese, I'm trying to remember exactly what it said, said that someone tried to push her onto the tracks and the Good Samaritan stopped that from happening in the city of Boston. I've actually reached out to the MBTA with a copy of that report going, are you guys tracking this stuff and what's going on? I'm still waiting to hear back from them on this one.
Wow.
So I want to know.
I can't help but wonder if COVID had originated in Germany or Italy or, you know, another country, would there be racism and violence toward that group of people?
No. No, trust me, no. I mean, it was like the whole, remember the whole stupid thing about freedom fries?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what happens. The French doesn't want to get into Gulf War. The best this country does is say they don't want to call things French fries.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, aren't really French, but whatever.
That's true.
I mean, you know, so no. I mean, we've already done this before. And people, oh, yeah, we treat them the same way. No, we've already done this. You know, if you're European of descent, you have a low, 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 low probability of racism in this country. If you're Asian, you have extremely high level of racism in this country as a result of international policies. And it's lost in folks on that because, again, the perpetual foreigner concept, right? You know, as soon as you start a trade war of any country, you know, you look at me and it doesn't matter because you don't equate me because the government doesn't equate me as part of the society when you start these wars. We saw a trade war with Canada. I don't see people kicking around Canadian people, right? We saw a war trade war with Mexico, and suddenly, you know, every person from brown skin South America suddenly becomes an enemy again. And Mexico, if you look at Mexico's history, United States, there's a long history of the United States also scapegoating Mexicans. You know, so it's not new. It's just I think people have accepted it so much as part of American life and culture and history. That's a norm. And again, we can talk about what systemic racism, but that's part of what systemic racism is. You accept this as a normal behavior. And then it's not your problem. It's my problem because I'm Chinese. It's my problem I'm Chinese, not your problem that you're perpetuating the issue of the systemic racism, right? This is what systemic racism looks like. So we can do a whole hour segment next time, but this is kind of part of that.
Yeah,
and this is the challenge that's interesting on so many convergences in 2020 going to 2021, you know, on American society, you know, waking up to these issues, they all at one moment separately, together as opposed to separately, it's kind of unique because you look at history, you know, the LA riots, Vincent Chin, Rodney King, any of the lynchings in the South through the 60s and 70s. You know, and you know, then you got the post 9/11 attacks on folks and Muslims and any South Asians. Like basically anybody had brown skin. I mean, post 9/11 was not good for you. You know, and it's people that are different. So, you know, it's a lot of moving parts, but it's interesting how a lot of these things hit all at the same time in one year.
Well, we can't have positive change until we turn around and face it head on and talk about it. So hopefully we're doing that a little bit on this chat today.
Well, I do appreciate you, your patience and my chats about racism issues. From my perspective, I only grew up here. I don't know. I tell people I only grew up in Quincy. But I mean, the coverage from QAT with the rallies, you know, we've been sharing that YouTube as well on my social media. You know, people can watch other wonderful program on QATV from, you know, whether you talk about COVID or what's going on at city council or at state level, but also community events. And, you know, as more community events come up, you know, obviously your channel will continue to broadcast those for people to enjoy. Not, and if you no longer live in the city of Quincy, the benefit of the internet, right? You can keep up at home. You can watch high school graduation and college graduation, even though you're at home to watch it yourself. And I mean, what this is part of a COVID world. If you got someone whose grandparents can't come and see their high school graduation of their grandchild for whatever reason, you know, maybe it's health, maybe it's financial, it doesn't matter. You know, this kind of medium provides that opportunity to share in a moment they wouldn't normally get.
Well, thank you, Techie. We appreciate that. We do take that responsibility very seriously and try and fulfill that for the community for sure. What can folks do to get a hold of you?
Well, 617-722-2014, 617-722-2014. I did hear from some folks that had problems managing the phone system. Again, hit any button and leave a voicemail. It doesn't matter who at my office you hit. We will get the message. Obviously, reach my email at tacky.chan@mahealth.gov, tacky.chan@mahealth.gov. I'll let you all know that I'm now receiving committee testimonies for bills and committees, so it's starting to get clogged up. But, you know, I'll once again sort and prioritize on needs first. You know, as you know, you've seen and we've enjoyed my Facebook page, you know, Tacky Chan, State Representative Tacky Chan page on Facebook. It's a public page. No need to have a Facebook account. We, you know, put on a lot of articles as well as important public service announcements and some resources, as well as the tackychan.org page, tackychan.org also does that well. And also we put links to these podcasts up here so you can see my hair grow or catch me on my flubbing. If you want to be nitpicky on me, I'm sure somebody finds that entertaining for themselves. And of course, you know, you could check my Twitter account, which obviously has very limited lettering, but, you know, at Tacky Chan. And you see it, a good speaker has a very active Twitter account. So maybe you can just, you know, you follow him for a while.
Okay. Sounds good. appreciate it, Techie. So good to talk to you.
No, it's always good to see you, Joe. And I'll catch you. Am I going to catch you Friday Memorial Day? Are we going to?
Yes, I will be here. And it'll be the day before the May 29th lifting of all the restrictions.
So, yeah, we're going to have one more chat before the restrictions lift. And then we have a chat to see how the world unfolds.
That's right, exactly. Hopefully. All right. Thanks again, Tacky. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you. See you next week.